metrics and quality metrics, supporting and implementing team-based care delivery models, which I've mentioned. And then the third, improving workforce knowledge, skills, and abilities to implement and work within care delivery models. And I think someone earlier this morning brought that point up, the challenge sometimes of the skill set of individuals in different care settings to be able to coordinate care in an appropriate fashion. But that's also an area that we need to look at. So this next slide is a slide that could only have been developed by an NQF staffer. I love all their boxes and arrows. It's very elegant and also really hard to read. This is another look at our approach and our task force's approach to promoting shared accountability across different care settings in order to reduce avoidable admissions and readmissions. We've tried to identify all those different stakeholder groups, again, that many of you mentioned today, not only the healthcare providers and healthcare professionals that we tend to look at, but also health plans, private and public purchasers, national organizations, organizations that have accountability for licensure credentialing. So really trying to look across all of these stakeholders and look at what are some of the drivers that can be brought to bear on this work, everything from workforce development, how do we use accreditation and certification to help move us in the direction we want to go, system redesign, public reporting, payment and contracting, and informed consumer decision making. And we've come up with a whole set of tactics that sort of crosswalk the stakeholder groups and these drivers in terms of framing some of the tactics that we believe will help us to reach our goal. I'd like to just take a little time to talk about, from the micro level, to move through from the macro to the micro level, talk a bit about the work that my own organization is doing, and we're just an example of one small organization out there in the field trying to work with healthcare providers to reduce avoidable readmissions. And as a hospital and long-term care membership organization, we've done a lot of work over the last couple of years to try to connect up the acute care settings with their local long-term and community-based care providers and to get them to actually talk to one another. And on one of, I think it was Jerry's slides, there was a bullet on communication. And it seems so simple and so straightforward, but it's one of the missing links between different care settings, actually getting hospitals and nursing homes, home-based care, to talk with one another about the needs of the patient and how those needs are going to be met and how they're going to be met through these different transitions and through care planning. And so we've been heavily involved in that work, have found that communication is certainly one of the keys, but we've also found in examining different approaches and models to this that there are a set of consistent practices across many of these that really need to be in place for these efforts to be successful. And I thought that it might be worthwhile as you begin to look at measures and families of measures and how they can influence better care coordination to keep these kinds of things in mind. And again, it's not rocket science. Those are things that we've all talked about, we've all identified, that there is something about the synergy between having that consistent set of practices that seems to be very powerful. Also, in Jerry's presentation, she talked about some earlier care coordination task force outcomes, one of them being preferred practices. And one of those that's, I believe, linked to this is Care Partners. I think that was one of the I participated maybe in that 2006 task force. And that was one practice that we've found in our work with families and patients over time is that it is the family and the patient that are doing most of the care coordination for themselves, often with no real tools or resources. And so finding ways to coach and to educate and to work with patients and their family caregivers to help them do a better job or feel more confident in their ability to manage their own care is really, key. And we've continued to do some more work around that. The other thing I always like to come back to is, what is that patient experience piece? You know, we're looking at a lot of evidence-based practices, but there's another part out there that I think, because we perhaps don't have all of the, you know, the research to support it, doesn't get as much play, and that's the patient's lived experience. So one of the things that we're trying to do as we work with patients and families in these different care settings is to talk with them about what their experience is like in these settings, and to use that information to trend those results. And we do this through a lot of patient interviewing and focus group work. And over the last 4 years, when we analyzed thousands of patient and family focus groups, and these are patients and families from long-term care settings as well as acute care settings, these are the top three concerns that patients and families identify in terms of care delivery. Dismissal of their voice, the sense that care providers really weren't listening to what they had to say, weren't really respecting their knowledge of their bodies, their health, their concerns. The second was the absence of caring attitudes from providers. And I wonder sometimes, how do we get at measuring that? Because it's a very important part of the experience of patients. And then the third was lack of continuity of care, so no real surprises there. We're also trying to make some small contribution to developing best-in-class measures that could potentially be brought forward to NQF. And we've got a couple of projects going on right now that are looking at measures of patient activation. There's more and more talk about patient activation as we move into an ACO environment. I'm not sure sometimes that we know how to do that. So we've got an interesting little project going on where we're using a patient's own health and wellness record that they populate with the help of a coach that looks at what's important to them, what do they want their health for, what are they comfortable with, confident in around their own management of their care, and what are they not, what kind of resources do they feel that they need. And we hope that there'll be some interesting results that come out of that. Again, realizing there are so many small projects out there like this right now, and part of our challenge is just sort of pulling them in, looking at some of the results from those, and then bringing them to scale. And then I just want to end on this note, as I often do. I like acronyms, and you know, of course, we love acronyms in healthcare. And we do a lot of work with the VA, and there's no place that likes acronyms more than the VA. So here's one for you: personalized, humanized, demystify. We've been talking about that for 35 years, that everything that we do in healthcare comes down to the patient and the relationship between the patient and their caregivers, and that those interactions should be personal interactions. They should be based on the needs of the human beings involved. They shouldn't be just the checklist or the task or the kidney disease in room 234. People should know that they are honored as individuals, as human beings, and that that will be an important feature of any approach to improve quality of care or care transitions or care planning. And lastly, that we demystify things to the extent possible, because many patients and their families don't know what we're talking about a good deal of the time, because we have our own language, we have our own culture, and they're often sort of left on the fringes of that. And so when we talk about, for instance, bringing the care team members together, and Frank, you were talking about in heart failure cases, bringing the different folks together that are involved in that, that should include the patient and the family. And yet so often we leave them out of that. So, again, just a reminder that it's important that we make the effort and find ways to involve them on an ongoing basis in these conversations. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you. Nancy?
Thanks. And thank you, Susan. That was terrific. So, thank you, Lindsay. So, as we're thinking about the improvements in the care across the continuum, there are lots of things that hospitals have been doing, lots of activities that we've been engaged in. and some of which were summarized right before we went to lunch. But all across this country, you will find hospitals actively engaged in activities to reduce their readmissions. What I can say uniquely about that activity is that as I listen to our members talk about what was effective for them, it varies from place to place and population to population. And that's because there is not a single set of common factors that are causing those readmissions. In some places, there are factors related to the lack of access to follow-on care. In some places, there are factors related to either inability or lack of knowledge about the appropriate follow-on diet. In some places, there are clear problems with the way in which we fail to do what Susan was just talking about, particularly around demystifying that which the patient needs to do for him or herself in order to continue on the path to wellness. Lots and lots of different problems, lots and lots of different issues arise, and I have heard so many different stories. It's amazing to me that there are so many variations on this theme. But what is common to the work is that people always talk to me as we work on readmissions or other outcomes about the fact that they want to know what the goal is. They want to know what target they're shooting at. What's the outcome of interest? What are the critical changes that should be made in the system as it currently exists to have the positive effect on the outcome of interest? In other words, what research has gone on? What are we going to bet on as the logical ways in order to affect that outcome of interest? And then what are the process steps? What's that package of changes look like for them? So for readmissions, and I won't in this particular presentation address potentially avoidable admissions because that's really a lot of activity that happens prior to hospitalization. But for readmissions, which has been the central focus of a lot of this discussion for hospitals, there are lots of different critical aspects of care. Some directly related to what the hospital could do, like providing a clear understanding of continuing care and what has to happen afterwards. Some of which is sort of lost to the hospital. They may advise the patient they need to do a follow-up visit. They may even recommend a physician if the patient doesn't have a primary care or cardiologist with whom they would like to visit after the hospitalization. But they don't have the facility in most cases to make that appointment or to ensure the follow-through on that appointment. So those are just two aspects of it. There are multiple aspects of it. One of our board members loves to tell the story about the fact that when he did an investigation at his hospital, what he found was that the local nursing home received these patients back, wanted to make them feel welcome in the nursing home, and served one of their favorite lunches as a result, bologna. Bologna sandwiches for cardiac patients was not really on the recommended diet and often brought them back. But the patients were happy to come back and get something that they saw as a comfort food. So a lot of coordination needed to go on and across all of these different facilities. What I hear hospitals asking for is for those who are working in this coordinated fashion at the NQF, at the NPP, at the MAP, to identify what are those clear and succinct actions that need to be changed. What are those things, major elements of the healthcare delivery system as we currently know it, that need to be changed? Who's responsible for making those changes? How can we get involved in helping all of that happen? And then know what are we going to be measured on? There needs to be measurement along each step of this way. We need good process measures. We need good interim outcome measures. We need good ultimate outcome measures. And having pieces of it without the whole is confusing and frustrating and leads to a lot of angst on the part of hospitals. And so that's really what they're asking for. So the design elements that seem to be essential are outcomes that are identified using data to show that we really have an opportunity for improvement, and there's evidence that improvement is indeed achievable. The critical elements of change, those interim outcomes that are chosen based on the evidence of what really will have an impact, and then the process steps so they know what they can get busy in doing. Because while we tend to have folks around this table who come from large academic institutions, and that's terrific, most of our smaller community hospitals don't have the resources themselves to ferret out what are the next steps, what are the things that they really should be investing their resources in. They want to have that more centrally located, more centrally identified, so that we can move as rapidly as possible. And they also want to a comment that I think Andrea made earlier, but what, you know, where do we provide the feedback about what's working, what's not working, how do we keep this moving forward, how do we raise those things that we thought would work but aren't actually working? Where does all of that feedback go, and how do we make that part of the effective improvement loop? And so with that, Frank, I'll turn it back to you.
Great. So far I've got PhD and no more baloney. Rich, I'm turning to you to help keep us on track here.
So Frank sort of misled the group when he thought, told you that the session on pain was this morning. Well, it's continuing now. And maybe there's some baloney mixed in as well. So I'm actually going to just about, there's about six different presentations that are embedded in here, but I'm going to go quickly because I know that this is a conversation more about the framework. But let me go ahead and launch. But before I even show you the next slide, here's the pearl. One size doesn't fit all. Second pearl. Getting care coordination measures right, whether they're structural, process, should be agnostic to age, agnostic to organ system. So let's go ahead and launch. I've already given you the takeaways. This is from the pediatric perspective, the proverbial village. Some people might call this the medical neighborhood. I much prefer this is the community of care, and you'll see how multidisciplinary it is, but all of these elements go toward providing optimal growth and development for a patient and family. What I'm about to show you now is a care coordination care map for a real child. Gabe is his name. Gabe is 11 years old. His mother is a colleague of mine. So Gabe, center of his universe is his family. One component of the care coordination map is the health map, and you can see it includes subspecialty care, primary care, pharmacy, but that's not all there is, right? So there is also a component on the educational world. This, by the way, is not hypothetical. It's real. There's also a developmental component to his care coordination map. There is also an advocacy, information, and leadership development for this mother and for the family and the community. There's also recreation and community because Gabe is not a diagnosis. He is a child. There is also a legal and financial planning perspective, and there's also a patient and family support, or I would prefer to say child and family support. So everything we talk about, I would like us to be thinking about this linkage. Now I'm going to dive into some data. Colleague of mine, Jay Berry, and some other folks have looked at readmissions in pediatric patients. And the dirty truth is there are comparable rates of 30-day readmissions for children with complex conditions that there are to Medicare beneficiaries, north of 20%. Gosh, I feel like I'm, you know, at Fenway Park behind a pole here, so please forgive me every time I turn my head away to read what the words are. So essentially, if you look at this group of pediatric hospitals, nearly 20% of the admissions and almost a quarter of inpatient charges were attributable to almost 3% of the patients with these recurring conditions. Many of the patients were rehospitalized for problems in the same organ system. Here's the beginning of laying the logical framework for why one size doesn't fit all. If you look at rates of readmission and you look at these complex chronic conditions, children with neuromuscular disorders, malignancies, cardiovascular disorders, and hematological and immune deficiency disorders, those tend to aggregate to the top. Significant spend, and we've actually called these high resource utilizing, HRU, children and youth. For Boston Children's Hospital, a place that that receives referrals from the region, that we are the community hospital for inner city Boston, for the region nationally and internationally, 0.5% of the patients are responsible for 20% of the spend. So we ask the following question. And notice, by the way, I haven't even used the term care coordination yet. It's around integration. What is the locus of integration? And supporting integration of care are care management or disease management strategies. Now we can delve into care coordination and establishing criteria for those so-called handoffs and tracking system-level performance. The so-called patient-centered medical home can be primary care-based, but I showed you the diagnostic categorization of these children and youth. It's not likely that many community-based primary care docs are going to be able to take care of them. So we're looking at subspecialty-based or academic medical center-based, quote-unquote, medical home. From the patient's perspective, what that means is single point of access to the system of care, and that is a way of navigating the system, and if you will, providing the care coordination. It really requires that systems approach, measures of care coordination within and across that medical neighborhood. Eric Coleman is a dear friend and colleague of mine. We took CTM3 and we actually, if you will, turned it into a pediatric relevant document. The elegance of this, it's if you think about CTM3, it's pretty embarrassing. Those three simple questions are that highly predictive. Why didn't the medical system start asking those things about 150 years ago? Interestingly, for pediatric patients, we administered an adaptive version, a CTMP, if you will, and parents of readmitted children were more likely to feel that their child's illness was not resolved, the reason they were admitted, the child wasn't healthy enough for discharge at the time, and that the child should have stayed in the hospital. And what we are finding, by the way, is that families' perception of readiness for, let's call it an admission to the community, as opposed to a discharge from the hospital, is that it's pretty highly correlated whether they're kids with special health care needs or not. This is another model, and I've actually used this model at the MAP before, so I'll bring it here to you. It's our so-called Community Asthma Initiative. Basically, we identify a cohort of children. These are not high resource utilizing, by the way. These are our children and youth urban core who have asthma. Based on ED utilization or inpatient experience, we actually send a nurse into the home. We prescribe, a HEPA vacuum cleaner. We do mattress cover. We do integrated pest management. And basically, we knock the cover off the ball. 80% reduction in admissions, 60% reduction in ED visits. The hospital was taking a bath in the era of fee-for-service. You can imagine we are jubilant in the era of globals. So our community asthma initiative, and by the way, these are already going out beyond 24 to 36 months. So the sustainability is significant. And because one child in a family with asthma, if it's got an allergic trigger, probably has others. So if you will, there's a herd immunity component of this as well. We did some work for the Commonwealth Fund a few years back to actually articulate the functions of care coordination. The ones in red I thought were most relevant to a conversation about it, strategizing on care coordination for potentially reducing readmissions. So the development of those care plans in conjunction with the families, not to the families, not for the families, but with the families. managing and tracking these tests, the referrals, and the outcomes. Coaching, right? The power of Coleman CTM3 is not the CTM3 itself. It's the coaching intervention. And it's not handing out fish. It is teaching people to fish and supporting and facilitating care transitions. This is a very busy document. I'm offering it to this group, and you'll have access to it. But this is also from the Commonwealth Fund report. I assume that there are... Yeah. So this sort of lays... I don't even think the laser goes that far. there it is. Good. Thank you, Andrea. So what we did is we actually put together functions of care coordination, enabling factors, and how the family would experience the receipt of care coordination or its lack. And then what we did is we segregated it on the basis of regional and community practice at the family level itself, at the level of national organizations, parentheses, NQF, federal and state government. And I'm not going to read those to you, but this document was informed by multiple stakeholders. The minority of stakeholders putting this together were physicians. The majority were families, purchasers, payers, social workers, and nursing profession, people that were actually doing care coordination. I'm sharing this with you quickly. It's a draft, but I have permission to share it. We are actually developing, based on this care coordination framework, a set of care coordination measures for children and youth with behavioral and mental health needs for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. When you look at the spend for this population, it's a very attractive cohort, so that's my medical director hat. For the father in me, how can we not take care of those patients, and the pediatric advocate in me? So I am excited to share with you that we're willing to get into those weeds. So I want to sort of give you a sampling of some candidate measures. The absolute essence of this is the patient and family experience. In fact, just last week, our PIES, Pediatric Inpatient Experience Survey, was given endorsement by the NQF. So it is out there. It's inpatient-based, and it assesses the family's experience of care in that setting, and it prepares the family for the transition back, if you will, to that community admission. Additional measures are around communication, the ticker survey, creating and maintaining the care plan, the fact of family engagement, and the transition from pediatric to adult care. A simple question, people have probably heard about some of the consumer reports reporting that came out of Massachusetts Primary Care, and one of the measures is around a sense of integration. Do you feel that you have all the information you need at the time that you need to make a recommendation for that patient and family? And then finally, the systemness measures. I can't wait to get my hands on some NQF-endorsed systemness measures because that will enable me to build out our system of care. So I'm getting closer to some concrete now. So looking at handoffs, CTM3, not post-discharge, pre-discharge. And if a yellow or red flag is raised, you stop the discharge process, and then you address with the family what the concerns are that are raised on CTM. Care plan co-created with the patient and family. That last one is in red for a reason. Receipt of the care plan by the next provider. It's not enough to say, I sent the care plan. It's not enough to say, I referred the patient to the psychiatrist. You have to make sure that the handoff is complete, so measuring both sides of that. So in conclusion, care coordination activities are essential to support optimal care across settings and providers. Care coordination measures are amenable to staging in the family paradigm. I was thrilled when the MAP was first exposed to those family measures because they fit beautifully with the work that we laid out for the Commonwealth Fund. Patient and family experience is essential. Caution in interpreting readmission rates. Different patient populations, different types of risk modifiers, socio-demographic, socioeconomic indicators are significant. A readmission does not necessarily mean that care in the hospital was poor. Oftentimes, and we're finding anecdotally, after about the seventh day, it has much more to do with community oopses and gaps than it did with the hospital-based care, and defining locus of accountability. And I just want to acknowledge everybody that went and gave me some input into this. So I thank you for your time, and I'm really looking forward to moving this forward with this group, with the MAP, and with the NQF.
Thanks, Rich. And I have to say, I'm someone who loves mind maps, so I really loved that portrayal of the patient. Next, we have Sean carrying us into the post-acute and long-term perspective.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. And that was great. I'm going to try and not repeat a lot of what's been what's been said, but I want to sort of give a 30,000-foot view of, I think, really two patient populations. Those are frail older adults and those living with serious illness who are transitioning into the post-acute care setting. Oops, not there yet, huh? The other group is the long-term care setting, is those within nursing homes, and particularly those with advanced dementia, because I think they represent a specialized but very critical population whose needs around coordination, as I hope I'll show you, are very, very different. And that's not me either. This is a conversation transition moment because I got a picture, so I can't start without the picture, without the pictures. But actually, I will preface it by saying that Frank started by saying that we're going to hear from some experts, and I am not an expert on this, but I did consult with real experts who gave me their slides to start. So I have to thank both Susan Mitchell at Heber Ruhab up in Boston, Joan Chino at Brown, and Ken Bookfar at my own shop, who really are the experts in this area. All right. Do you want my flash drive, Lynn?
If I have it. There are 15,000 thoughts on that. But, sure.
So I want to do this using sort of two patient examples because I think it puts it a little bit in perspective. And actually, the first one is easy for me because this was my grandmother. We talk about how did I get into geriatrics and palliative care? It was personal experiences. But this was also the personal experience that focused a lot on the needs of those with people with seriously ill older adults. So this was my grandmother. It was taken when she was about 84 years old. She was living at home with my grandfather, who, would, in another talk, was, the epitome of successful aging. But at baseline, she had type 2 diabetes, oxygen-dependent COPD, CHF, osteoarthritis, frailty syndrome, And God love her, she managed to try to reach for a pot in her kitchen on a large pegboard and fell and fractured her hip. And, you know, the ideal path for somebody like this, and I picked this example specifically for Frank because it's a surgical example, and, you know, we talk a lot, but this could have been anybody with, you know, a frail older adult with advanced CHF and a CHF CHF exacerbation. But, the ideal path is, you know, she comes from home, she gets herself into the hospital, we do a really nice transition depending on her needs to acute rehab or subacute rehab, and then she goes back home or to a nursing home. Depending on how our needs are, you know, there's 1, 2, 3 care transitions that have to happen. The reality, though, and this is from our data on hip fracture, is that if you take 1,000 people, just like my grandmother, who go into the hospital, this is actually what happens to them. You know, this could be an NQF Stafford diagram. Because the reality is, you know, you just look at the number of real transitions that somebody who has a simple, you know, surgical problem, simple I say, like a hip fracture or a CHF exacerbation, exhibits in our current healthcare industry or system, depending on where you are. And indeed, if you look at Eric's work and Ken Bookvar's work and Jenks's work, that, you know, when you look at transitions in older adults, that for those all comers, with 1 month after discharge, somewhere between 16% to 18% will have 2 transitions. That doesn't include the home or nursing home to hospital transition. And again, somewhere between 13% and 19%, depending on the diagnosis, will have 3 or more. And indeed, 1 in 5 will be readmitted back to the hospital within 30 days after leaving, if you look at that subsegment of the population. What happened to my grandmother is sort of typical, or for an older, seriously older adult who gets hospitalized. First when she came in, her Valium, and it just killed me that as a geriatrician my grandmother was taking long-term Valium, but indeed she was. It got admitted and she became acutely delirious because of withdrawal. After hospital discharge, her sodium wasn't followed up and she became acutely lethargic from hyponatremia and managed to get herself readmitted for that. She didn't get a bowel regimen for her opioids, so she got impacted and went into the ED and managed to get herself disimpacted in the ED. And most importantly, she was completely surprised that she wasn't going to be able to walk normally for up to 12 weeks because, quote-unquote, nobody had told her that. She expected to be doing just fine after her hip fracture. This is work from Ken Bookvar, and I apologize. Somehow the Mac to PC translation messed up my figures over here. But when you look at the risks after transfer, and this is, again, familiar to all of you, but, again, looking at the subpopulation, about 42% will have a drug-prescribing discrepancy. 12% will have a test that isn't followed up. There'll be a workup discrepancy in 8%, and almost 50% of older adults will have at least one of these things happen to them across at least one transition. And you think about the fact that we're looking 2, 3 or more, it just magnifies the effect of that. This has real consequences because of the 5% of these drug prescribing discrepancy results in an ADE or a measurable ADE, and these ADEs complicate 13% of hospitalizations. We've talked a lot about this, but just to reemphasize it, you know, we have, you know, best practices in sort of 2 areas along transfers. One is, you know, the transfer of the patient and the communication with the patient and actually getting them safely from A to B. And the second is this transfer of clinical responsibility, which is, you know, what I think about across care settings and the shared accountability of that. You know, ensuring the communication about providers, provider reconciliation and synthesis of the information, and then deciding on and implementing the care plan so that everybody's on the same page as to what are the appropriate goals for this particular patient. Again, this is review and it's been hit before, but, you know, very, very, you know, critical 4 steps that I think need to happen. If new information is discovered, compare it to the older sources, identify and record the differences, alert the team leader about the differences, especially when planning choices need to be happened, and then key is informing, education, and bringing the family on board. I want to shift gears in the next 5 minutes because Lindsay told me I had only 10, and talk about, you know, another, I think, really important population that we typically don't think about in terms of transitions, and this is a very different type of transition. This is actually one of Joan Tino's patients many of you know Joan. She's a geriatrician and health services researcher up at Brown, also a really accomplished photographer. This is the only patient she's ever photoed, and this is actually Joan's Labrador Retriever down here. This is an 85-year-old widower with advanced dementia living in a nursing home, and sort of put this population in perspective, he doesn't recognize his family. He doesn't have any verbal abilities. He's non-ambulatory. He's incontinent. And he's one of 5 million Americans right now, but projected to be close to 16 million in 2030. So not only a large segment of the population, but one that's growing pretty substantially. The data on advanced dementia is that 20% of people just like this person are going to die in a U.S. hospital. And Joan's work and Susan Mitchell's work have looked at the last 90 days of life for this population. And what they found is, on average, you know, there are 1.6 hospital transfers for this patient population in the last 90 days of their life, and at least 20% of them will have a burdensome transition defined as hospitalized in the last 3 days of life, multiple hospitalizations, that's one or more hospitalization in the last 90 days, or being transferred from nursing home A to a hospital and then being discharged to nursing home B because they exceeded their bed stay in the nursing home under Medicaid. And that these, you know, burdensome transitions have really adverse outcomes. Again, this is Joan Tino's work looking at nursing homes or patients that are in the lowest quintile of burdensome transitions, the second quintile, the third, the fourth, and the highest quintile, looking at the relative risk of having a feeding tube. And if you look, you're in the highest quintile, you have a 3.4-fold more risk of having a feeding tube placed if you have a burdensome, you know, if you're at the higher rate of burdensome transition, having a stage 4 decubitus ulcer developed, being in an ICU in the last 30 days of your life, or being referred to hospice. And this is fascinating because hospice, late hospital referral is defined as 72 hours before death. I would actually consider that to be a very, very late hospice referral. And Susan Mitchell has talked about the idea, what's the best practices for this group? It's probably not a transition at all, and this is why I bring it up into care transitions, is the idea that probably best practice is to avoid the transition completely for this population. So what, when we're thinking about measures, what has to happen? Well, you know, we've talked, you know, there's a lot of focus and attention about, does advanced care planning work? This is probably the one population where it works really, really well. And the idea of focusing on the idea of completing physician orders for life-sustaining treatments, or what are called medical orders for life-sustaining treatments in states that are there available, appropriate do not hospitalize orders for dementia patients in long-term care. You know, simply having a mandatory goals of care discussion and treatment plan tailored to those goals. And as others have pointed out, it doesn't make sense to transfer somebody, not to transfer somebody if the quality of care within the nursing home is not sufficient. That what we don't want is we don't want to not transfer somebody to a high quality, for example, palliative care team in a hospital because the quality of care in their long-term care facility is suboptimal. So, you know, along with this, we talk about having, you know, combined sets of measures that really emphasize high quality palliative care within the long-term care setting to prevent these transfers. I want to just end with a quote to just sort of describe how we can make just a very straightforward difference. This is from the daughter of one of those patients that I described, and she says, here's one thing that I've never forgotten. When they were hauling my mother back and forth to the hospital, the last time they took her in there, there was a nurse. It's always a nurse, by the way. She said, you know, you don't have to. They don't have to bring her in here. You just tell them no. Well, that was the end of the hospital trip. I always felt like that woman was somebody special. And let me just, I will stop there and hopefully kept to 10 minutes.
Great. Thank you very much. Rhonda had to step out, and she was next on our list with a community behavioral health perspective. So she's on a call, and when we get into the measures, she'll probably work some of her comments in at that point in time. So if we could now, Rich, could you give us the health plan system perspective?
Sure, be glad to. I don't have slides, and my first instinct here is to kind of get into some of the issues of advancing the alignment of primary acute and long-term care providers and integrating Medicare and Medicaid, and how all of that fits. But I'm going to stick to my assigned kind of focus here, and that is to look specifically at the issue of shared accountability, and particularly as it relates to admissions and readmissions. So with that kind of lens, I think it's first important to recognize that I think it's timely and important that the National Quality Forum really has kind of stepped out in looking at the issue of shared accountability for any particular intervention, given the kind of relationships that we see here that exist in all of these presentations. If you think about a broader kind of perspective of five or more, people with five or more chronic conditions account for like 66% of all Medicare costs. If you look at Medicaid expenditures, they're all related to frailty, to disability, to comorbidity, to complex kind of conditions. It's really with people who have all of these complicated interrelated problems where the problems of care really exist. Secondly, in looking at this issue of shared accountability through the lens of a health plan, I think it's important to note that health plans in some ways are uniquely qualified, if you will, for addressing issues of collective matrix. They're paid a full perspective of resources, have contracts with a full array of primary acute and long-term care providers. They have an ability to kind of contract, monitor, guide, incent behaviors as it relates to collective performance. So I think that there's an important role to play here for health plans. Unfortunately, most health plans really don't have a contract with all the key players that are involved in care of people with multiple complex ongoing care needs, frail, disabled, chronically ill. A significant percentage of costs are related to people with Medicaid. And yet there's a disconnect between Medicare and Medicaid, so you have many health plans who really don't have accountability for the Medicare side of things, where there are things that are highly interdependent. If you look at post-hospital discharge and use of nursing home care, health plans don't always know or have a relationship with the specific nursing home that a person is discharged to from the hospital. There may or may not be a relationship there that a plan can really get its arms around. Many health plans really focus on short stay nursing home care. And so if you look at the kind of problems that exist in terms of long-term care community, those are heavily Medicaid-related. Many health plans really don't have a role in dealing with the complexities, the multiple kind of admissions, readmission problems for people who have major disabilities, who have major frailty. Fourth here is, I think it's fair to say that most health plans are more like insurance companies than they are provider-placed plans. We clearly have Kaiser and other kind of provider-based plans. But if you look at health plans from this kind of insurance perspective, their primary focus is making sure that there's access and coverage of services within a defined area rather than trying to select a group of providers that are likely to be most effective in working together. They're really kind of susceptible to whatever conditions of participation or standard operating procedures exist within a requirement, so that kind of health plan, if there are poor hospitalization or rehospitalization rates, it's likely the plan's likely to have poor hospitalization and rehospitalization rates. Unless the plan kind of has a significant critical mass, significant relationship with the care providers that are actually involved, then it really doesn't have the kind of leverage it needs in order, or relationship, you know, it needs in order to address many of the kind of things that have been discussed here. So it's plans are positioned well in terms of the kind of mechanisms that are important, have an important role to play, that there's a lot of deficiencies in terms of what allows them to kind of pull levers, provide incentives, whatever, given the complexity of the problem. I think it's also important to keep in mind that risk adjustment is really still in its infancy. You can't really get into monitoring and measuring, comparing performance for rehospitalization or trying to identify who really has the responsibility for dealing with shared accountability and improving it. Unless you deal with risk adjustment, this is a very important issue for members of the SNP Alliance, where plans exclusively or disproportionately serve people who are frail, who are disabled, who are chronically ill. And I think we all know that hospitalization and rehospitalization rates for frail, disabled, chronically ill people, people with severe and persistent mental illness, multiple comorbidities, they have very different kind of hospital and rehospitalization rates than other populations. And so if we're going to look at shared accountability in relation to plans, where there's enroll in plans and do comparative kinds of things, it's important that we advance risk adjustment here before we kind of move this into a payment structure, very quickly. So things like age, sex, welfare status, geography, culture, disability, comorbidity, all of those affect what a rehospitalization or a hospitalization rate is going to look at. Plans have clearly capabilities of dealing with system issues, but most of the requirements for plans, as well as the operational structures, are not organized around enabling them, empowering them to do kind of collective accountability management. They, too, have compliance issues in relation to specific HEDIS measures that are very event-based, that are, very specific illness-based. You can look at billing and claims information, but get a feel for how certain things are happening, but that really doesn't provide you with the real-time information you need as to what's the problem behind the admission or the rehospitalization or the initial hospitalization that's somehow dysfunctional or inappropriate. And if you don't know that, that kind of information in a timely way, then it's difficult for a plan to, effectively fulfill that kind of role. And so with these kind of concerns, I think it's fair to say that plans are going to be kind of nervous about getting into the role of assuming some shared accountability for certain things that it really doesn't have a lot of ability to control, where it isn't even clear as to who is accountable for a certain kind of problem. I think it's also important for us to keep in mind that there's a lot of different drivers here going on for the kind of behaviors that we're all looking at and wanting to change. Plans sometimes think, or people think plans should be able to achieve certain outcomes. But, if a plan only has 10% of a provider's business relationship, it doesn't have the critical mass to have the relationship it needs to change things. If you look at why providers do certain things the way they do, look at conditions of participation. They have admission, care planning, discharge planning requirements, and if you look at conditions of participation for all the different hospital, nursing home, home health, physician, all of those are quite different, and they tend to drive people to manage care within the walls of their own setting, with their own kind of environment, and to be provider-sensitive, centric, rather than to be a collaborative. It's just kind of the nature of how we have things structured. So I think these, my point here is to not to say don't proceed here. My point here is to try to identify some of the real complication, real issues, real important issues that are that we have to take into account if we're actually going to operationalize a shared accountability, collaborative kind of an approach. And I would also suggest that it, you know, the notion of hospitalization, rehospitalization may or may not be the best place to start here. You know, that clearly is an important one, and clearly an important one from a hospital perspective. But, you know, if you look at other transitional care issues, interdisciplinary team issues, some people say if we really want to create change, the kind of vision that National Quality Forum has, you got to change a primary care practice. You have to change how primary care and related interdisciplinary care teams, you know, operate. Or look at medication management. You know, that clearly is a transitional care issue. It's an admission issue. It's a disability issue. It's a confusion issue. It's a safety issue. You know, it may be that in terms of, and everybody somehow is involved. Lots of people, particularly people who have complicated problems, have lots of different prescribers, as well as their different people who touch that person, who affect what's going on relative to the effect of the medication, whether they're taking it, whether they can do some things functionally around that medication or not. So, you know, kind of in closing here, I want to say reducing admission and readmissions is real important. You know, I don't want to undervalue the importance of that. But if we kind of stretch out over time, and here for a minute I'm going to kind of think, you know, where is our trajectory, where it should be the National Quality Forum's trajectory of thinking as we move forward. You know, the fact of the matter is people with multiple complex ongoing care needs are healthcare's most vulnerable, highest cost, fastest growing service group. That's really where all the problems are. We all know that the system is broken in relation to those, you know, that particular group of people. So to be responsive to that need, it seems to me like we really need to develop not only a new generation of care, but we have to develop a new generation of payment methods and program policy and performance evaluation, all of which affects the kind of outcomes that we want to achieve in more of a collaborative approach to care. It seems like we need to move from thinking from treating symptoms and problems in specific places at specific points in time to treating longitudinal multidimensional care episodes for defined populations across a continuum of interrelated care providers. It seems to me like we need to move our treatment and care models from disease-based to condition or population-based care management structures. It seems like we need to move our delivery structures from being provider-centric and simply looking at which of our provider-centric measures we can share with other providers to be more person-centered and system-oriented. It's a different way of thinking. It's a different approach. It's a different paradigm. And that paradigm needs to be applied to measurement as well as care. We need to realign the incentives among related primary acute and long-term care and behavioral health providers. I would suggest to change the normal trajectory of a person's illness. You know, is our focus to simply prevent a problem or reduce a problem, or if you think about people with multiple complex chronic conditions, there's a normal trajectory of where that illness is going to go over an extended period of time, you know, whether that's generally down in terms of disability. Well, it seems to me like in the collective, if we focus on bending the trajectory of illness, we can, in effect, begin to bend the cost curve that enables people to live longer, to live healthier, and where there are significant cost savings in the process, and where the outcome can be reduction in hospitalization rates and other kind of things. But where the focus is really on collective behavior that's person-centered, that's focused on populations, that kind of changes the direct trajectory of what the problem, person's problem, really looks like. And as a result, I think if we want to do that, we need to then move our whole measurement process from kind of a predominant use of disease orientation, intervention orientation, place focus, into this more of a population-based system-oriented approach to performance measurement. I could go on here further, but I think I'm going to tie this up in terms of my particular comments. I'm a big fan of the National Quality Forum. I think they really have stepped out front in providing important leadership on health system transformation, and I just want to encourage to push that envelope even further and looking at what it can do to advance a new generation of performance measurement that is more population-based, that is more system-oriented, that kind of gets us out of our silos and gets us functioning as kind of collaborative partners in care, which is what we all really want to do, you know, to start with. It's just these other constraints. This is more about bad systems than it is bad people. And so let's develop some new structures that enable everybody to work differently. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much. So we've covered a lot right now, and we're going to need to take a quick break and come back, and we're going to dive into the specifics as we move forward in this. So let's go ahead and do a bio break, get something to drink, and within, let's say, less than 10 minutes, let's reconvene and get going. All right, let's grab our chairs. So we are right now behind schedule, but we've got the patient surveys addressing care coordination. I don't know if we'll get to that today. So we're going to try and get through our first efforts in looking at the avoidable admissions and readmissions, and we've got a reactor group to look at that. And then our next is to look at system and infrastructure support measures, and we have a reactor group to look at that. The key point right now, though, is for the rest of our afternoon, we're really starting to get tactical. So instead of these strategic discussions, as we move into these more tactical discussions, brevity is the theme of the afternoon. So if it's already been said, no need to say it again other than we agree. And if we disagree, let's disagree, but let's be succinct and start focusing on the measures themselves so that the work the board's asked us to do will come from the measures. We've done a lot of setting the stage, and I think everyone's been great in sharing some of the initial foundation, but now we need to make it work. So our opening charge here is the avoidable admissions and readmissions, and the reactor list, if I've got this right, is Richard, Christy, Anne-Marie, Aparna, and Amy. Is that correct? And Dolores, welcome. No problem. Richard, if you'd start us off.
Okay, thank you, Frank. So there is a long list of these measures, and I'm going to work off of our printed copy. And what I tried to do was bucket these measures and so we can discuss them as groups of similar measures. And I came up with five buckets. So I'll describe the buckets, and then I'll describe pluses and minuses in each bucket. The first bucket are those measures that deal with home health, so 0171, 0173. These are looking at the percentages of patients who either come into the hospital or go to the emergency department within an episode of home health care. The measure is said to be risk-adjusted, although when I went on NQF site, the risk adjustment slot was blank, so I'm not sure how it's risk-adjusted. I guess the plus is it is claims-based, so if you think it's important to know How many of these home health episodes result in an admission or a visit to the ED? It's probably easy to capture. The negative for me is I'm not sure how I would interpret this. I don't know what the optimum number is. Certainly some home health visits are going to result in transfer to the ED or hospital. The alternative is the patient isn't visited and dies at home and gets removed from the measure. So it's not clear to me what the optimum measure would be or how I would use this. The second group are measures of that are population-based admissions or readmissions, and these are mostly the ARC measures. So these are 277, which is congestive heart failure, 281, urinary tract infection, 272, diabetes short-term, 274, diabetes long-term, and 0638, uncontrolled diabetes admissions. Now, these are all ICD-9-coded discharge abstract data based. I think for me, these measures are, I think, epidemiologically problematic in that the denominators of these measures really are not that they do not consist of the patients with the condition. They consist of the entire population at a county level or another metropolitan level. So if we're going to look at, for example, CHF admissions, we're not looking at CHF admissions out of the CHF population. We're looking at across the board. So I guess you can say at a first approximation, if the prevalence of CHF is relatively equal across all counties, it's probably an okay measure. I don't know if that's an adequate assumption. I think the prevalence of these conditions does vary from county to county. The other problem with this is that small counties will exhibit extreme variations, both high and low. So you're going to come up with random variations that you're going to misinterpret as a real finding. So I found these particular ARC measures problematic. The other two population-based measures were the ASC, the acute surgical center measure of admissions to a hospital after outpatient surgery. So this looks at all patients who visited an acute surgical center and then had to be admitted to a hospital. That seems like a useful measure. It's not risk adjusted or case mix adjusted, but it provides you with some information as to how many outpatient surgeries end up in the hospital. And the second similar measure, which is a population-based measure, is 1381, asthma emergency department visits. And this looks at all asthma patients who have to visit an ED, and it counts one or more. So if you visit the ED five times, you're counted as the same as if you visited one. So it's looking at one or more. So this will give you an idea, I guess, of outpatient treatment failures, how many of these patients show up in the ED. The third cluster of measures involves the 30-day all-cause risk-adjusted, risk-standardized measure for specific conditions. So we have a number of these, 0330, which is 30-day readmission following heart failure, 0505, 30-day readmission following AMI, number 506, 30-day readmission following pneumonia, 0695, readmission following PCI, and then there was one that followed stroke, which I think was not on this list, but it's on the big list, which is 0705, readmission following stroke within 30 days. So all of these measures are basically similar. They look at a 30-day period. They look at readmission to the hospital for any reason. They are risk-adjusted with the hierarchical model developed by Krumholtz at Yale. I think one problem is they don't really account for planned versus unplanned. You can say, well, why would a CHF patient or a pneumonia patient have a planned readmission? The point is, if you say were an oncology patient and you had pneumonia, treated successfully, within 30 days you went back for a planned visit for your therapy, you would still be counted. There's really no way to exclude that patient. But without, you know, that aside, it does try to risk adjust based on comorbidities, age, and sex. What the model does, what some people take as a weakness, is it really is, it points out the outliers. So you have a small number of hospitals that are over-expected, a small number that are under-expected, and then a great swath within the middle, which are basically as expected. I'm not so sure that's a problem. I think that's kind of a characteristic of the state of the art of our risk adjustment. Maybe that's the best we can do. I think the problem comes when you try to then draw lines and say, let's look at the 25th percentile, because really, statistically, this model says if you're in that swath, in the middle, you are, none of these hospitals is statistically different from any other hospital in that swath. But I think sometimes it doesn't get used that way. So some of these are already in use. So the 30-day all-cause readmission following heart failure is in public reporting right now. The AMI measure is in public reporting. The pneumonia measure is in public reporting. The PCI measure is not. Nor has it been proposed yet. The hip and knee measure actually has been proposed, although it's not yet adopted. It's in the current rule proposal, and the stroke measure has not been proposed. So there are a couple that are already being used and some that are not being used. The fourth bucket are the bridges to excellence measures, which look at potentially avoidable complications, and they look in certain populations. So we have 0704, which looks at the potentially avoidable complications in a 30-day period for AMI, and then 705 looks at the same in stroke, and 0708 looks at the same in pneumonia patients. Now, these measures, potentially avoidable complications, my knowledge of these, this is based on methodology that Lisa Iazzoni developed in the early 90s. It buckets patients into surgical, major, minor, non-surgical, and then it looks for certain ICD-9 codes that then says if this code appears, this is a potentially avoidable complication. I do not believe this has yet included the POA, although I may be wrong, but I'm fairly sure, given how they were developed, it does not include the POA. And so I would consider these actually, I think the word potential might be misplaced. I think these are potential complications. To me, these are useful screening measures. If one appears, you want to go and look to see if it was a complication, but it doesn't necessarily 100% predict this to be a complication. I think the usefulness of it is we probably do want to start moving in this direction. We need to figure out morbidities. I think the downside is we don't really know if we're identifying something real or if the algorithm's picking up a documentation or coding issue or something that was present on admission. So those are the trade-offs. The last bucket are the all-cause, all-patient admissions, hospital readmissions, which are 1768 and 1789. So 1768 is the plan level, all-cause readmission, and 1789 is really a hospital level, all-cause readmission. When we looked at these as a committee, we had some discussion as to whether these should be reconciled, but we concluded that, no, they're really measuring two different things. The plan measure, although it doesn't use the same risk adjustment or methodology as the hospital measure, is trying to figure out, within a given health plan, how many patients were readmitted in a 30-day period. It does not try to look at planned versus unplanned. It does risk adjust, and it looks at similar types of patients. So I guess the argument is if you've got a large number of patients, large number of covered lives, statistically, yes, some will be planned, some will be unplanned, but that will be, by the nature of the comparison, it will sort of wash out, and we're looking to see if you've over expected value for that for your particular patient type, and it's at the plan level. The hospital-wide all-cause unplanned readmission is one that probably caused the most controversy, and this was the this was the measure that looked at readmissions of all patients in a hospital readmitted within 30 days for any cause. It uses the Krumholtz methodology of the risk standardized readmission rate. It does try to separate out planned from unplanned. Probably is not perfect, but I think it makes a valiant attempt from the methodology I review to separate a planned from an unplanned readmission. It includes measures of comorbidity, age and sex, and the risk adjustment model. It does not include measures of socioeconomic status in the model. This was problematic at the committee level when we reviewed data that showed that at a population level, things like DISH status or Medicaid penetration did impact the readmission rate in a statistically significant way. There was a lot of discussion about how that should be handled. The committee felt we didn't want to bake it into the risk adjustment because that would essentially solidify disparities of care and maybe mask them. But the committee did accept the measure with a usage statement that said like patients should be compared to like. In other words, high DISH hospital should be compared to high DISH, et cetera. So you want to compare like to like. This went through the endorsement process, made its way to the steering committee. It was accepted. It was controversial in the sense that the membership vote on this, the majority of votes cast were against the measure. But if you actually looked at the council by council vote, more councils accepted this measure. I think it was a 5-4 or whatever the equivalent is in NQF. But one of the councils cast one vote. So it was a very the three councils that were representing providers, physicians, and quality all voted against it. But be that as it may, the majority of councils did accept it. The steering committee approved it. There was an appeal that was filed by eight institutions. I think the second time in history that an appeal was filed. No? Multiple times. Okay. Nevertheless. So, I think the basis of the appeal was, there didn't seem to be true consensus. Two, it seemed as if the socioeconomic status, when there was a lot of data presented from the AAMC, that showed, yes, this is a real metric, and it was felt that that wasn't really accounted for properly. And I think there was some worry about unintended consequences of looking at this. And the steering committee upheld the approval, but it did issue a usage statement, which is a fairly complex, fairly long usage statement, which basically says when this measure appears, it needs to be accompanied by the statement that readmissions are multifactorial and represent factors including access to care, patient adherence, and multiple other factors, six or seven were named. So that's where we stand on that. So that's the summary of my summary of the readmissions measure.
All right. Well, we're going to go on to Christy in a minute, but I want to come back here, Richard. I want to ask the other reactors as you go through these, think about which measures you want to include, which measures are potential inclusion with modifications, so we would put those in the gap bucket. What do you not see as worthy of inclusion for whatever reasons? And then as you reviewed these, did you identify a gap? So that's what will then come to the whole group to discuss. Inclusion, include with modification, goes into the gap bucket. Don't include, and the gap. Christy?
I got my new set of instructions. I'm so glad Richard went first. and I'm not going to repeat everything he said. I'll just make a couple of comments. From the inclusion standpoint, prior to this conversation, I was kind of bringing in to my recommendations that the vast majority of these would be measures that I would include on the list. There were three that I was not going to, and I'll just explain a little bit about them. They're primarily the diabetes measures. And in looking back through the measures and trying to say we want to look at those things which are of high priority, it appears that from some information that's been released from ARC, that some of the measures, especially the congestive heart failure, the urinary tract infection, and the asthma emergency department population health measures, probably got to some of the highest reasons for going back into the hospital from a readmission standpoint. I'm sure I could be convinced to include the diabetes measures as well, but it was trying to say if we want to have some parsimony on this list, that perhaps the diabetes measures would not need to be included because they don't rise up to the same level in terms of reasons for being readmitted to the hospital. On the population health measures, I appreciated Richard's point about the fact that these are kind of gross prevalence or incidence rates, not looking at the underlying condition and how prevalent is it within the community. I do see value to these population health measures, and I would recommend that we include them for now, but they could be on that list, Frank, of, you know, either a gap or some way to say, you know, that maybe a more precise measure may be of all of the congestive heart failure patients in your community, what percent are coming back into the hospital. I think that was a really good point, but given we don't have that at this point, I would still recommend that we include the population health measures. Down at a community level, there is a lot of work being done at the community level to help set priorities on what you want to look at. And I think having these population measures is a real important aspect. The 30-day all-cause readmission rates that we talked about, as Richard indicated, they are in use. And although we have some actual concerns about the methodology because of the hierarchical components of the risk adjustment methodology, I do feel that they should be included in this list. They are being used. People are finding them worthy in terms of helping them make decisions around those issues, and so would recommend that they be considered. I think definitely the all-cause readmission at the plan level, to some of the points that were being made earlier, from the purchaser's perspective, I think that purchasers are looking to their plans and holding their plans accountable for the coordination of care across the settings. And so I think this is a very important aspect, albeit that there are challenges to that. But I think we need to have that measure so that we can see the plan's effectiveness. So would recommend that it be included, as well as the hospital-wide all-cause unplanned readmission measure that Richard indicated earlier, as really a way of measuring the overall impact of readmissions at the hospital level. I think those are most of my comments. I'm not sure I got them exactly in the buckets that Frank mentioned, but hopefully I did. So thank you.
So, Christy, just to be clear, the diabetes measures you were talking about are on page 5, the 272, 274, 638. Those are the ones that you would say you don't have any heartburn about those being included.
Correct.
You would not include those.
That's right. I would suggest that they not be included and that we focus more on those primary ones that we mentioned earlier.
And there were, when it came to the all-cause, there were several that were condition-specific. Were you?
Yeah, I'm recommending that we include those.
Okay. Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie?
I pretty much agree with the home care, and also I think the ambulatory care one, I think ambulatory care surgery is a good one. I think that you shouldn't really be doing ambulatory care surgery. You should try to take cases that won't need admission. I agree with what Christy just said about the risk adjusted for the, diabetes indicators. I think they could go into the same bucket as she said. I think I'm going to be a little controversial on the avoidable, on the readmissions and the 30-day readmissions. I think what we've heard from every presentation here is just how complex this readmission issue is. And we have to remember that right now, these are still linked to hospital acute care, the whole bunch of them. And that basically, they're not just being tracked, they're being, hospitals are being penalized. And even within that confidence interval, it's not just the very low ones that are being penalized, it's where you fit in the average, it's a very complex formula. So I actually personally think we shouldn't include any more of them coming down the pike until we really face this issue of whether or not some of the intense psychosocial factors should be included as a risk adjustment, or that other parties should be part of the readmission accountability picture. And as long as the only people who seem to be in the accountability picture for these very complex systems are the hospitals, I don't know that we should be promulgating more of the same kind of measure, such as an all-cause readmission that sits with the hospital. So I'm not in favor of those. I know some of the horse is out of the barn and they're already there and CMS is doing it. But to then add an all-cause readmission, and I think statements like, well, you know, you should take this into account, you should take into account that these are complex measures, doesn't really move people to really think very hard about this whole issue of readmissions. And we've heard four presentations today about how complex this is. So I would just say that I would prefer, rather than us endorsing coming out, which I don't know that we will, with a strong statement, because this is a very complex area, and before we go forward with adding additional readmission measures that are really very tightly linked to hospitals and that kind of penalize hospitals, that we think about the continuum of care before we kind of go further with this and that there be another relook at what's happening. So that would be my recommendation on those. As to condition, the complications afterwards, I think that those are, I think without present on admission, I'm not so sure whether that makes sense if these are older and don't include that. So I have some reservations about that. I think the concept of looking at complications that could be tightly tied to what we did in a hospital are good things, but I'm not so sure where these are. Maybe these need to be looked at more and kind of processed more and see if they really are measuring what you want to measure before you get them out there, because I could see these becoming, again, some kind of financial look at whether or not certain things want to be paid for, and I have a little reluctance about that. But the concept that if these complications are tightly tied to the kind of care that we provided in the hospital and right after hospitalization, I think that those could be good, but I think they may need some more work before they'd be out there.
So, Helen, can I ask you a question on those? And just to, Anne-Marie, just to be sure, you're talking about the bridges.
The bridges, excellence, yeah. The complications after.
So is there POA in 705, 708, 709?
I don't know, I'll have to check.
Is that, so while she's checking, okay. Then I had another question. Regarding your comments about readmissions, in those four categories of inclusion, potential inclusion with modifications, don't include in GAP. What I'm hearing from you is this is potential inclusions with modifications.
Yes, but I think those modifications would have to be real, and I think there's been such resistance to looking at these psychosocial and other factor adjustments. But that's the kind of modification I'd like to see, and I think there's been a lot of resistance to really looking at this. I know the argument is disparities, but I think that's a little curious. I think it's just hard to measure these things, and that's why it's not been looked at quite so clearly. I'm not trying to say that you let anybody who deals like our public hospitals off the hook for this in any way, shape, or form. But I think that you need to look at readmissions the way everybody here today has looked at readmissions, which was just a very complex issue. And the accountability has to be spread, and somewhere I think that has to be talked about more directly. That's all.
Great. Helen, have you had a chance yet? Do you need more time? Okay. Aparna?
So I'll try not to repeat some of the points that have been made. So in terms of the diabetes complications measures, I would agree with, you know, with the other Richard and the others, that it would be preferable to focus on the cohort of the diabetes population to see off that cohort, you know, what's the complication rate rather than the way it's sort of defined right now. And then in terms of the whole sort of set of measures that pertain to complications, to me, one of the ones that was appealing was the potentially avoidable complications that was across multiple conditions. And I think that would be, you know, I look at this list of measures here, and I think there are a number of measures here that would be much more meaningful to consumers. And from that standpoint, the potentially avoidable complications measures, I think based on some of the research that Judy Hibbard recently did, you know, that's one thing consumers got is if something bad happened to them, they understood that it was poor quality. And so I think from that standpoint, those are, you know, important measures for us to consider. In the readmissions sort of category of measures, I'd be in favor of including all of them, including, and that's inclusive of the hospital-wide all-condition readmission measure, just because of the increased focus that we're placing on that issue through the Partnership for Patients and other initiatives. And then I think in terms of the gaps, I think I talked about this earlier, adding the ED visits to the list. I saw some of the measures that were included in here, but they're not currently endorsed. So I think that would be an area. And then I'm also sensitive to the issue that Andrea raised about looking at readmissions and mortality in combination. So that's the other issue that I wanted to raise again, and think it would be important for us to look at the two together.
Great. Thanks so much. I think I've got all yours. Amy?
Okay. Some ways I think it's actually harder to go last. I will try not to repeat anyone's comments. The avoidable admissions ones, the first two would be acute care and the emergent care. I like those a lot, but I think they need to be broadened significantly beyond just home health to capture other avoidable admissions. I think that's an important concept to capture both because in and of itself as an avoidable admission, but then also how avoidable admissions and avoidable readmissions kind of seem to go together in some of the studies I've seen. And so I think measuring both could kind of give a more complete picture of, frankly, some of the care patterns in the community beyond, you know, just looking at a hospital. I like the concept of the avoidable admissions at the county level, but I do see that those could be challenging to implement or use at a hospital level. In the interest, I mean, if we really wanted to go parsimonious on 30-day readmissions, I think our choice would be to go with the all-cause readmission measures, both the plan and the hospital. It's two measures as opposed to breaking them out by condition. I recognize that's not super palatable to everyone, so I don't know that we'll get there. But I think those are important concepts. The 30-day plan readmission, in addition to helping purchasers make decisions about who they contract with from a health plan perspective, as we look at the exchanges and consumers making decisions about health plans on those exchanges, I think that could be useful information for them to have to compare the plans. Same thing with the potentially avoidable complications. I agree with what Aparna said. You know, that's something that consumers get. They understand it. I think it's a useful concept for them to make comparisons. And again, if we had to be parsimonious, the one that covers the broadest number of conditions, I think, would be useful. A gap that I saw is that none of the readmissions measures cover pediatric patients. They're all for the adult population. I did see a PEDS ICU readmission measure under care transitions, but it looks just at a 24-hour window. So I think there's, you know, expanding to cover that population would be useful.
Okay. Helen, were you able to?
Yes. follow-up things. So the nursing, home health measures are risk-adjusted. Richard, I'm happy to share the details with you if you'd like to see it quite extensively. We can find the evidence of prison and admission adjustment for the PACs. And just a couple other comments on readmission measures, because Richard brought up the issue of planned readmissions. We are expecting to receive, I don't know exactly when, the planned algorithms for the other condition-specific measures to sort of match the hospital-wide measure. And then lastly, we know that there are both pediatric and nursing home readmission measures in development. We have not seen them yet, but we know they're actively under development. I think that's the list of questions.
Okay. So from this list, we are now open to the entire group. I will just kind of run down what I've heard, and I apologize. It was not easy to capture all these thoughts. There were a lot of great thoughts out here, but on the very first page, page 4, we had 171, 173, the two home health measures. There seemed to be support for including these and even at some point in time recommending a gap to expand them. I heard a positive for 265, the avoidable readmissions for ASCs, the only comment being that it would be nice if this was risk-adjusted, but speaking myself as a surgeon, we kind of risk adjust it by selection. Those who are going into ASCs really are not supposed to be admitted afterwards. So, and I agree with the developer on that one. Then on 277, 281, congestive heart failure admission rate, urinary tract infection admission rate, and the 3 diabetes. I did not really hear anything about inclusion. So if there's something that we need to be explicit about there, I've heard those were do not include. The asthma emergency department visit had somebody speak in favor of inclusion. That is measure 1381 on the bottom of page 5. And then we really have a mixed conversation. And so I'd almost want to push this conversation to the back end of our discussion regarding the readmissions, the various readmissions measures. It seemed like we had two groups out here, one saying include only the all-cause, and another one saying, let us recommend potential inclusion with modifications. So a little bit of it goes back to the drawing board. So let us group all of those together. And then the last one, I think it's the last one, are the bridges to excellence measures, the PACs, the potentially avoidable complications where the point was potentially a great measure, but needs POA, and they don't. We just heard from Helen that they don't have POA, so that could be something for you to consider. So is that a fair grouping? We'll talk about the readmissions last, but we'll take all these other measures first. Christy?
Just one slight correction. I was recommending that we include the congestive heart failure and the urinary tract infection population measures that are on page 4.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you. That's okay.
Okay.
It's confusing.
Aparna?
On my part.
But on the diabetes complications, I think I can't speak for my colleagues, but I thought we wanted to it would be good to have that measure, but looking at, among the diabetics, not have the denominator be the general population, which is, I think, maybe what we're recommending is a potential gap.
So is it potential inclusion of the measure with modifications, which
yes,
means we don't
that's
recommend
kind of
it?
My, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at, but I don't know about the others.
Okay. That's different from don't recommend. But we're not recommending it, but we're sending it back to the drawing board. I got that right? Okay. So we're just opening up the dialogue at this point. David?
Yeah. So on the ARC-PQIs, I would like to suggest that we think big and think future. We seem to be at a time when people are talking about creating accountable care organizations. Those are entities that are going to be held responsible for the management of a population. These measures could be respecified for those entities, and to the point that many of you have made, they could be limited to those patients with the condition. So I'm identifying that as a gap. We don't have those measures specified the way we would like. Maybe our friends at ARC will pick up that ball. Maybe they won't, but I hope somebody will. So that's one suggestion. And then,
David, just to, so I can be clear, the measure number would help.
Okay, so I'm talking about that cluster that is, if you look at the second column, they're all PQIs, but the numbers are 277, 281, 272, 274, and 638.
So is your recommendation then
put them in a gap,
to
take off from what's there to identify a serious gap, which is those population-based measures being applied at the ACO level.
But do you want to include them, or are there future potential inclusion
with modifications? Future potential.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then I guess I have a question on I'm strongly in favor of the potentially avoidable complication measures. I've, went through the process with the CSEC on those. They're really among a small set of measures that really get at what's important. I don't understand the question about prison on admission. The denominator is defined by a person who's been admitted to a hospital. And all it does is track what happens to that individual over 30 days in a defined set of complications. So what does prison on admission have to do with that?
So these are the Bridges to Excellence measures that have been put up there. I've got Nancy. No.
So I just wanted a little clarity coming back to a question I asked this morning. I don't know what it means to include measures that are where the level of analysis is the county, city, or state, since the programs that the MAP is asked to recommend measures for don't pay at any of those levels. So I
asked Tom the same question.
Okay, thank you. Not just me.
Okay, so for our families, we're hoping to have related measures that not only would cover the particular programs that we might get measures for on the list at the end of the year, but we also want to begin to promote that public-private alignment, and that would include at many different levels of analysis, such as national level, regional level, state level, community level. For example, community alliances that might be reporting at a population level might want to look at our families and say, okay, we want to begin to align with what's coming out of Medicare, but we also need measures that we can report within these families at a population level. So that would be one example of potential reason to put a population level of analysis measure into our family.
Do you have a question back on that?
Well, in my experience, having multiple measures of the same things just gives you confusion rather than help. But
I guess until we have, we talked earlier about measures that could cover across all of these levels of analysis versus finding the related measures that we currently have available, we're sort of in a transition there. We need to determine as a group how we would cover different levels of analysis if it isn't through related measures.
Rich?
I wanted to speak briefly here to the plan all-cause readmission.
We're going to hold the all-cause discussion. So Just hang on to that one. Let's get through everything else, because I think we'll have a dialogue on that for a while. Randy?
That was going to be something like that also, but I just want to make a couple of the comments that I said to made at previous meetings. One is, if we're going to do population-based measures and if things are going back for reconsideration, we should look at, again, whether absolute numbers of readmissions might be a better measure than percentage. And secondly, put the same thing, and particularly with the all cause, if if it's a hospital, if it's measuring a hospital, then 30 days might be too long a period, and if it's measuring, if it's patient-centric, what's important to the individual, then 30 days is too short.
Richard?
So the first two on home health, I mean, I don't have any problem including them. I just would want someone to explain why are they useful. If I'm missing it, I'd like to be informed. So I wouldn't know what to do with those two. ASC, I think I agree with including it. All the population-based measures, I agree with David. If we get down to more accountable populations, it's going to be even more important that we get the denominator right, and we're not making decisions based on prevalence rates. The only exception might be urinary tract infection, which I guess you could say everybody's at equal risk for that. But in general, I would not include measures where the denominator is not epidemiologically sound. And then for the present on admit, I agree that we need to move forward in a way with looking at these morbidities. The problem is not with the 30-day. It's really with the index admission, which is also scored. And when you look at some of these secondary diagnoses, you assume that they're a complication. But if you actually look at the POA, and a large number of them turn out to have a POA present, so the POA cleans up a lot of that noise. And I think that should be identified as a gap, and I don't think we should include the measure until that's incorporated.
Yeah, it required a deep dive into the submission form. So it doesn't look like it's specifically POA, but they do specifically say for the PACs that these claims are included as PACs only if the PACs are not present on admission.
Oh,
it doesn't look like they use a simple POA. These are, I think predate some of the POA work. But they do clearly say that they only include if the PAC is not present on admission. So I can try to get more detail, but that's all we've got.
Susan?
I apologize in advance if this is something that maybe the group has already discussed and decided on, but it does strike me that the three bridges to excellence measures are not measures of avoidable readmissions as they're labeled. They're measures of potentially avoidable complications. And given that there are so many avoidable readmission measures, that could be a little overwhelming. Maybe it would be helpful to label them differently.
Connie?
Sure. Frank, I just want to add something on that, and thank you for raising the distinction on these bridges to excellence. And I know that we have some members here from our cardiovascular diabetes task force, but I want to bring to everybody's attention that part of the discussion in terms of complications, avoidable complications for those individuals who have diabetes or cardiovascular disease, number 709 was something, at least, again, for that task force, focused on diabetes and cardiovascular disease. They felt like this would be something good to include, but would want to track the use and experience of this. There were some, still some concerns, but enough of an interest to pass the threshold to make it into their family of measures. So I just want to provide some context. If we are carving this away, there was another task force that did select 709.
Okay, great. Mitchell? Oh, you're good? We got it. Ron?
I'm not good. I'm confused. So I am in favor of the first three because they're relatively specific, 171, 73, and 265. I agree with the earlier suggestion that we have to do something with the PQIs, which start with 277, and, whether those are all in or reworked in another way so that we handle the concept differently. contradict myself just a little bit and say that asthma talks about ED visits, which is a little bit different than the EC, than the readmission one. So that one, I think, is an important one to keep. And then we get into what I'm confused about, which is last month, when it came to actually dying, mortality, and I checked our table again at the end, which we'll get to sometime tomorrow, we had death by this, death by this, death by this, death by this, to about 35 different things. And we managed to lump all those in the one roll-up measure that we could feel at least somewhat comfortable with, and that's the one that's in our table. Whereas now, for readmissions, we're going to keep you're readmitted to pneumonia, readmitted for, you name it, left toe hurts. And so how are we delivering a consistent message about trying to achieve that parsimony, or at least that parsimony within our committee? And how do we explain that to people that wonder how one group of measures had, 30 in them and 15, another one ended up with one, especially when a lot of them are the same group of people? So we just got done throwing out mortality due to 30-day mortality due to heart attack last month. Doesn't mean they couldn't use it, just means we said, all right, doesn't need to be in the smaller set. And here now we're going to include readmissions for all that. So I just wanted to...
Well, I want you to hold that because we're not in the readmission conversation yet. But that point will come up in just a moment. All right, so let me just walk through the measures that I'm hearing, and we'll see if where we are on consensus. This is all the measures that are in this group except for the readmissions measures specifically. So let me get to the beginning of this. The 171, 173, the two home health, and the ASC hospital transfer on the first page, I'm hearing to include those as general consensus. All right? I'm on the on the 277, 281, all the ARC measures on that page. I'm hearing that I'm not hearing consensus to include. It's kind of a mixed message here because these are at the community, county, city, state level. And on the diabetes measures, there were three of those, and I heard comments to consider inclusion and also not to consider, and they're also at the community level. So my sense is on those, that whole set, was there were potential opportunities for inclusion, but we really didn't see how they fit in the program. David?
I don't really feel strongly one way or the other about including them as stated, but I wish we could make that strong recommendation to develop the measures in a way that would be applicable to an ACO or like accountability.
So that fits perfectly with potential inclusion with modifications. That'd be a gap statement on all that whole group.
There actually is technically still an endorsed PQI composite. Now, some of the elements of it have been changed out and evolving over time, but that may be one way to get at parsimony, that might be the thing to actually kind of fix going forward rather than the individual condition one.
And so if you want, we can include the composite statement. Next on this list, I have the asthma emergency department visits for inclusion. And I'm skipping over the readmissions for the moment, and I was hearing on the PACs concerned about the POA, but it sounds like the POA has been dealt with. So does that mean we include the PAC? Because that was our only contention of potential for inclusion with modifications for POA, but it sounds like POA has been handled. So I'm hearing inclusion of the PAC into the measures. Okay? Asthma's in. And the floor is then now open on the readmission measures. Lance?
And just before we get off this topic, just a couple more gaps. If we're going to include the PQIs as a gap, can we add to this that maybe we ought to develop a PQI-like measure that includes drug complications-related metrics, since we saw that was a very common reason?
Great point.
And also mental health.
Okay. Thank you. We'll add that to the gap statement. All right. So we're now in the discussion about the readmission measures, the 30-day all-cause readmission measures, and I think Ron teed it up pretty nicely by challenging us, given our past performance on mortality measures. Rich?
Yeah, I want to be clear here in speaking of this. I'm speaking primarily through the lens of special needs plans who serve a defined population. We have historically been very supportive of, in fact, a high bar accountability for plans. We think it's important that we include measures and respond to measures and are publicly accountable for what we do. We also do an annual survey and we of our members, and we collect all-cause readmissions, 30 days readmissions, and see that as generally a good thing. Having said that, there is kind of support under certain condition becomes, I think, the entrance of the alliance. If you have a plan, I mean, if it's all cause, but you have plans that exclusively enroll people who aren't all cause, then issues of risk adjustment become real important. As an example, if you have a plan that exclusively serves people with severe and persistent mental illness, and you're compared on an all-cause readmission to another plan who exclusively serves people with diabetes against a plan who exclusively serves people in nursing homes against a plan that exclusively serves people who are poor, and compared to plans that have all causes involved in their system, unless there is clarity around a benchmark, what is an appropriate all-cause number for these different kind of population segments if you're focused on a specific problem. And unless there's kind of proper risk adjustment in the communication, public communication of what is being measured here, I think there's unintended consequences of penalizing plans that choose to specialize in care of a population rather than assume a general population. So while there's interest in all-cause readmission, we collect all-cause readmission. We're doing it within the alliance in part to learn more about kind of what's unique as it relates to plans that may specialize in certain populations and begin to create a benchmark. But from a public accountability standpoint, we don't perceive that kind of capability in place.
Great. Thank you. So we have condition-specific readmissions. We've got all-cause readmissions. And right now, it looks like the entire list is included. We need guidance from the group as to where you want to go with that. Richard?
Here's what I'll say about the condition-specific readmissions. I think if they are used as the risk adjustment intends them to be used, which is you can report them, you can report the outliers, then I think it's fine. If you start to use them for payment and start drawing lines at different percentiles where the risk adjustment does not support that, it basically says you're not in those two statistically significant bars, you are not different from anybody else. If we don't recognize that and we then start drawing lines and setting payment, I think that's inappropriate. So it really comes down to how they're used. And I could support their looking at them, reporting those statistical significant outliers, if you will, but not using them in a payment sense if they're not used with the appropriate risk adjustment model.